Chris Williamson, former Labour MP for Derby North, joined the Labour Party in 1976, been a dedicated activist for the Labour Party throughout my 43 nearly years membership, got elected onto Derby City Council in 1991, became the spokesperson for housing, then chair of housing, went on, became deputy leader and leader of the council in Derby, and got elected to Parliament in 2010. And lost my seat in 2015 by the narrowest of margins. In fact, it was the most marginal seat in England, and then won it back in 2017. Got behind Jeremy Corbyn's campaign, when he managed to get onto the ballot paper and was very active in his leadership campaign, touring the country, speaking at constituency Labour parties, urging them to support him, nominate him, etc. Did the same thing in 2016. Then, as I say, got re-elected to Parliament in 2017, and was Jeremy's most vocal supporter in the Parliamentary Labour Party, embarked upon a democracy campaign to supplement the democracy review that Jeremy instigated, although that didn't include open selections for MPs, which was one of the things that I was campaigning for. And then there was a massive campaign against me by the right wing of the Labour Party and the Parliamentary Labour Party, and of course the Zionist lobby, because I'd been a strong advocate for Palestine and a vocal critic of the Zionist lobby. And I was smeared and abused and accused of being I wasn't actually accused of being an anti-Semite myself, but for facilitating anti-Semitism and allegedly being a Jew baiter. Absolutely appalling calumny. And ironically, most of the accusations against me were for defending left-wing Jews who'd been suspended and expelled from the Labour Party.
And what about now, Chris?
Well, I mean, I've since I was dropped as the Labour parliamentary candidate in 2019, even though Jeremy Corbyn had assured me that he'd spoken with the National Executive Committee and that I would be endorsed as the official Labour candidate. That was just a week before the NEC decided to drop me on the recommendation of Jenny Formby, who was allegedly a left-wing supporter of the Corbyn project. I decided then to fight my seat as an independent, inevitably lost it, and since then, with others, have founded the Resist movement, which has recently agreed to register as a political party, but we've been in discussions with the Socialist Labour Party with a view to a merger with the SLP, because in my opinion, and the members are voting on it right now, we had an online meeting last night. There was an indicative vote there, and it was unanimous actually of the members participating to support the move. And so we hope that if members do agree that, and you know, the final negotiations, discussions with the SLP go well, that we can formally, as it were, merge and join together with the Socialist Labour Party at the Labour Party conference. Actually, we've got a meeting already booked in the calendar for the 25th of September, which is the start of the Labour Party conference, I believe, where we will be formally, launching this new venture, as it were. So it's a bit
fascinating. You talked there a bit about Jeremy Corbyn and the potential failures in his leadership. I think many people on the left looked at this as, maybe the first opportunity since Harold Wilson that had been to have a genuine left-wing, leader of the opposition and potentially prime minister. What went wrong with Jeremy?
I think Jeremy surrounded himself by people who were not really up to the job, who constantly backed down, retreated, surrendered, sought to appease the opponents of the socialist anti-imperialist project that Jeremy was spearheading, that was incredibly popular with members and indeed with the country as a whole. And it was as a result of that it weakened his position. I mean, I was a lone voice in the Parliamentary Labour Party, indeed in the socialist campaign group of Labour MPs, who said that we needed to push back, that we needed to draw a line in the sand, that we needed to be pushing the leadership, Jeremy, and others in the leadership to go further, actually, in terms of the, you know, the socialist agenda, because all the pressure I was saying was coming from the right wing. And so, you know, they were constantly fighting a rearguard action, and we needed to be creating the space for Jeremy to move into, as it were. But that just never happened. And the other point I was making is that we have to resist the smears that are being perpetrated by the Zionist lobby and then being used as a stick of convenience, if I can put it like that, by right wingers who could see that it was gaining traction. I made the point repeatedly, directly to Jeremy and to the Socialist Campaign Group, that every apology that was made, every you know, piece of ground that was given, was merely feeding the beast and making it bigger and stronger, that they wouldn't stop, that we absolutely had to push back and fight back. And I said to Jeremy, look, you've got, of all people, have got nothing to apologise for. I mean, you've done more than certainly any other MP at that time to, you know, resist and fight racism. I mean, when the Tories who were jumping on that bandwagon, the likes of Norman Tebbit, who went along to that Board of Deputies demonstration that was organised, claiming that, you know, the Labour Party was institutionally anti-Semitic, when you know, right-wing Tories were wearing badges saying "Hang Mandela," Jeremy was on the doorstep of the South African embassy, indeed getting arrested outside the South African embassy, campaigning and protesting against apartheid. So, you know, he had an unimpeachable record, and I was saying he needed to fight for that and stand up for that and call these people out. And, you know, he had a perfect, in my opinion, a perfect alibi to do that, because many of the people, as I've already said, that were being targeted were themselves Jewish. I mean, you know, children of Holocaust survivors were being accused of anti-Semitism and being expelled from the Labour Party for bringing it into disrepute. You know, son of a rabbi was an Orthodox rabbi, was himself, I think, the first Jewish member to be expelled. You know, others, I mean, Jackie Walker, former vice chair of the Momentum organisation, she was accused of anti-Semitism and eventually expelled. And ironically, her parents were forced out of the United States of America during the McCarthyite witch hunt in the 1950s. And, you know, irony of ironies, Jackie, their daughter, ended up being the victim of a McCarthy-style witch hunt in this country, within the Labour Party of all political parties. You know, the party that certainly me, in my youth, and indeed in older, later life, really, you know, always thought as being the party, you know, that stood out against that type of abuse, that, you know, that stood opposed to apartheid and witch hunts, etc. And it turns out that, you know, this party was engaged in a vicious witch hunt, and very happy to defend, you know, pernicious apartheid state of Israel. And you know, it's an absolute bloody travesty of justice, really, what's happened.
Well, it is, but I mean, I think with better leadership from Jeremy and more decisive leadership, the irony being, Chris, that now Starmer is in charge, he seems to have done exactly what Jeremy should have done while he was in a different, you know, the left rather than the right, which is what Jeremy should have done. Anyway, look, what about leadership now? Who do you think are the potential leaders for a left-wing party? I mean, we've got people like Ken Livingstone, for example. I mean, I know he's getting on, but I mean, he's got an enormous amount of respect, and he took on Margaret Thatcher, and he had a massive comeback too in London.
Yes, indeed. I've got a great deal of respect for Ken. I'm not sure, though, he would necessarily be up for, you know, leading a new alternative party. And indeed, Ken still seems committed to the Labour Party, and indeed was seemingly supportive of Sir Keir Starmer. Just to go back very briefly to your previous point, though, about the ruthlessness that's been demonstrated by the right wing since Sir Keir Starmer has assumed the leadership. I mean, Jeremy didn't even need to be as ruthless as they are being. I mean, just an ounce of that ruthlessness, as it were, that determination, I think, would have seen us through. But I mean, you know, obviously it's important that you get good leaders. Clearly they have a really important role to play. But I think what's even more important than that is to try to galvanize a mass movement to give people the confidence to, you know, be their own leaders in that sense. And I think that's where the focus ought to be on rather than necessarily, you know, seeking out, you know, a new leader as a sort of messianic type figure, as it were. I mean, you know, yes, I'm sure leaders will emerge, but the key thing for me is building a movement, really. And I think with what we're seeing with this cost of living catastrophe and the trade union movement stepping up to the plate, I think is really encouraging, actually, with the number of industrial disputes which are being called and the support that they are receiving from the wider general public. I think is a source for great hope for the future, really. You know, the Enough is Enough campaign is an important step. I think, you know, people like Mick Lynch have come out and been very clear in their determination and have made it very absolutely abundantly clear that it isn't simply an issue about their members. They're talking about, you know, the wider cost of living crisis that, you know, millions of people are experiencing at the moment. And
we seem to be in a very surreal world, Chris, where I'm hearing on right-wing radio stations and even from Conservative MPs talks about nationalisation, renationalisation.
Yes, I mean, I think that is popular. Well, we actually know, look, even before this crisis that we've seen, which has in large measure been precipitated by the counterproductive sanctions which are being imposed on Russia as a result of the proxy war in Ukraine. Well before that, when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the party, opinion polls overwhelmingly demonstrated that there was support for bringing the utilities into public ownership. And that support has only grown. And yes, it is interesting to see, you know, people across the political divide now calling for the nationalisation of the utilities. And, you know, in Europe, where utilities by and large are in public ownership, and certainly we have more interventionist governments, there is a cap of you know, a few percentage points on the increases that they can impose on energy costs, whereas in this country, you know, people are seeing their energy bills going through the roof. And for small businesses, it's even worse. I was reading a piece earlier this week, or last week it is now, isn't it, which showed that like there was a chip shop owner, for example, who'd said that their fuel bill had gone up from £9,000 per annum to £32,000. And a medium-sized hairdressing salon, their energy bill had gone from £18,000 to £72,000 a year. These people just simply, these are just, you know, unattainable bills which are being levied on these small businesses. So,
yeah, so you know, do you mind, Chris, just taking a step back from all of this and explaining what is going on? Because it does seem we may even get a new prime minister soon who has absolutely no plans for bringing this these industries back into public ownership. In fact, possibly with no idea what to do and no power. They're being told by lawyers, well, you can't bring these into public ownership. The fact of the matter is, even with the railways, some of these train companies have been brought have come back into public ownership anyway, without anybody really trying, just because the private train operating companies haven't been able to make enough money.
Yes, that's happened on a number of occasions where they've not been able to, you know, make it work. You know, the franchise that they bought into, they've not been able to make it work. Ironically, when they've then been brought back into public ownership, they've demonstrated to be profitable, and as soon as that has happened, they've then been flogged off into the private sector again. The problem you've got is that both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party are committed to a, you know, neoliberal orthodoxy. There is no willingness to, no appetite for bringing the utilities into public ownership, no appetite really for interventionist government. It's a very kind of light touch approach that was the feature of the new
place. Chris, it's also the opposition, isn't it? What is the thinking going on in the Labour Party at the moment that cannot support these strikes and cannot even call for nationalisation? What they seem to want to do is to maybe put windfall taxes on the new companies, which is just putting off the problem. You know, so they're not really prepared to bite the bullet at all. What's going on in Labour now?
Well, Labour's been taken over by a bunch of neoliberals. Tony Benn warned about this years ago. He talked about the cuckoos, the new Labour, as he referred to them as being new Labour cuckoos in the Labour nest. And, you know, I've made this point repeatedly, that the cuckoos have taken over the nest now, broken all the, you know, the traditional Labour eggs, as it were, and they are in complete control. We had a chance when Jeremy Corbyn was leader and we had a mass membership to take it back, as it were, to push these new Labour cuckoos out of the nest again and to reclaim it. But that chance was blown. And so the Labour Party has been lost. The Labour Party is now controlled by a bunch of capitalist neoliberals who will tinker at the edges. I mean, there'll be some marginal difference between a Labour government and a Tory government, but it will be no significant difference, just as there wasn't much of a difference, really, from New Labour to John Major and Margaret Thatcher before him. And I think Margaret Thatcher herself said in around about 2002, I think it was, that her greatest achievement was New Labour and Tony Blair. So, you know, we've been living in a situation in this country, a neoliberal orthodoxy in this country, for over 40 years now. I mean, it was kind of, well, actually, I mean, the first sort of monetarist government was Dennis Healey's and Jim Callaghan. Well, Jim Callaghan was the prime minister in 1976 when Dennis Healey went to the International Monetary Fund, IMF, on a false premise that the country was running out of money, which is absurd when it's a currency issuing nation. But as a result of that, they drew down this loan, but never actually used it, ironically. And Healey subsequently acknowledged that it was a mistake and he'd been given false figures. But they started introducing monetarist policies. And the austerity package that the IMF insisted upon paved the way for Thatcher. And then Thatcher turbocharged the monetarist turn that had been taken by Jim Callaghan and Dennis Healey and the rest of the cabinet. And, you know, the rest is history. We've been living with the consequences of that ever since. And, you know, those consequences are what we're seeing right now. We've got 14 million people living in poverty. We've got a cost of living catastrophe, millions of people in precarious employment. The vast bulk of our manufacturing jobs that, you know, Britain used to be, you know, hailed for its engineering excellence have been offshored to low wage economies. We're now predominantly a service economy, service sector economy. Financial services have been given a status that they don't deserve at all. They don't really create much wealth in that sense, not in terms of the wider general public. Certainly don't create anything that's worthwhile for people. And, you know, the consequence of that has left so many people in a very difficult situation. And when you are then faced with a crisis that we are faced with now, it leaves the country incredibly exposed. And yet we still have a very big economy. I mean, we've got the fifth biggest economy in the world. And it's all about political will in the end. I mean, you know, if there was political will, then we could quite easily take these companies back into public ownership. We could quite easily eradicate poverty and, you know, eliminate homelessness, etc. It's just about political will and redistribution of income and wealth in this country. I mean, we need to, the Labour Party's never going to do it, but an alternative to the Labour Party needs to recapture the spirit, well, certainly of 1945, although that wasn't a perfect government when you look at its foreign policy agenda. But the 1974 Labour Party manifesto committed the government to an irreversible shift in the balance of wealth and power. And that's what we need to get back to. Now, that's never going to happen with the Labour Party. But a new party, I think, you know, certainly a socialist Labour Party that we're talking about, you know, merging with the Resist movement, that is, or System Change is the name of our political party, talking about merging with the Socialist Labour Party. And, you know, I think a rejuvenated Socialist Labour Party has the potential to capture the imagination, to, you know, win over a lot of people. I think the zeitgeist is such right now that, you know, people are looking for a radical alternative to the status quo, which is all that's being offered by the Labour Party and the Tories. And I know that the Labour Party...
Yeah, it's pretty much... I mean, I think you're right. It's a bit of a fix-up, basically, a neo-conservative fix-up, basically. Yeah. But you come from Derby, which I think I'm right in saying is an old railway city, where that was one of the main industries there. It's incredible, it seems to me, that all these, you know, dyed-in-the-wool, working-class parts of the north of England turned to the Conservative Party. I mean, what happened there, and what can the left do to start to capture those? To give people in Derby something to look for.
Yeah, I mean, well, Derby certainly is a railway city, but it's more than that. I mean, it was a manufacturing city. I mean, Rolls-Royce, don't forget, is based in Derby. It is still the biggest employer in the city. But many of those jobs have gone. When I left school in 1972, there was around 120,000 manufacturing jobs in Derby. It's down to about 25,000 now. Rolls-Royce is still the biggest employer at around about 11 or 12,000 employees. It used to, when I left school in 1972, have 35,000 employees at Rolls-Royce alone, and many other companies have now gone. But people have abandoned the Labour Party in places like Derby and further afield in the coalfield communities. But I don't think they've necessarily turned to the Tory party. Some of them will have done, but they've just simply stopped voting Labour. They've just not bothered to turn out and vote for any political party. And I think that's where, you know, any new party needs to be focusing a lot of its attention on the people who feel completely disenfranchised and have, as it were, given up on voting. And indeed, you know, I've been making this point for years now that, you know, the route back, I used to say, for the Labour Party was to win over support from people who have been disillusioned, because the biggest cohort in every election are the non-voters. I think at the last election, it was around about 15, nearly 16 million people, is in that sort of order anyway, of voters who didn't bother to turn out. And you know, there's a lot of potential there. And I think one of the things that Jeremy Corbyn was doing is actually inspiring a substantial proportion of former non-voters, as it were. But, you know, at the minute, you know, you've got Labour and Tory sort of vying for, you know, disgruntled, essentially Tory voters. I mean, I'm nothing against, you know, Tories having a Damascene conversion, but I don't think that necessarily is the way or the route to power. I mean,
okay. What about energy? Because that's one of the main things in people's minds at the moment. I look back at the 1970s and the 1980s, the coal disputes. We have a tremendous amount of coal in this country. We're now being told that not just coal is no good, we're not allowed to use it, but also oil and gas. I mean, this does seem to me, in a way, that back in the 1970s and 80s, Arthur Scargill and the miners were at the front edge of something which has now brought us to this situation where we're relying almost on our eggs in the nuclear basket. We've seen the failure of this new reactor in China. And we're putting all our hope to these EPR reactors, which we're quite concerned here at Hinkley Point down in Somerset, that even when it's finished, it might not work when it's switched on. So we're facing this energy crisis, which is going to affect everybody. It isn't really affecting everyone. Was Arthur Scargill right back in the 1970s? Maybe we should have kept some sort of least reserve of coal-fired power.
Well, I think Arthur was absolutely 100% correct. I mean, in his predictions for what the government had in train for the coal industry, the number of pits that were being targeted, if anything, he actually underestimated rather than sort of overestimated the number of pit closures. So, yeah, I mean, I think Arthur was absolutely right. He talked about energy security. He talked actually back at that time about, you know, clean coal technology, recognised that, you know, that was an issue. I mean, we do need to be mindful about the impact of climate change. We do need to, I think, be looking for renewable sources of energy. We should be embarking upon a major retrofitting of energy efficiency measures on all domestic and commercial premises in the country. We could massively address fuel poverty by properly insulating everybody's home, as well as looking at reducing the cost of energy. But I think a lot more research needs to be done into renewable sources of energy. There's a range of different options, it seems to me, that could be addressed and could be very labour intensive and could actually generate, you know, a lot of good high quality jobs for people. And you know, with political will and a commitment, you know, and a reduced working week and a job guarantee scheme and a recognition of the abilities, the opportunities that are available to a currency issuing nation. I mean, we could resolve all of the, you know, the major difficulties and problems that people are encountering in this country in terms of, you know, high fuel bills and poverty and precarious employment and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but it seems we've almost been stitched up, Chris. I mean, certainly when I was a young man, you could hop on a bus for threepence, get into the town, hop on a train. It was very, very simple to get around on public transport. Then we were tempted into our cars with cheap fuel, cheap cars themselves, cheap all these lovely new motorways. Now we're being told to pay more and more and more for our fuel, but public transport is not there. I mean, here in Bristol, we've been told several of the companies that set up private ones to run the buses have just gone, and a whole load of bus routes have been taken off just in the last few months. So I think, in any way, if you do want to go on the bus, you're paying a vast amount of money just to stay on board. So it does seem as if there's been a kind of, particularly in transport, a kind of adventure.
Well, there has. It's a consequence of neoliberalism, 40-odd years of neoliberalism. That's precisely the result, the end result. I mean, deregulation of the buses happened in 1985. Nick Ridley was the Environment Secretary that pushed the legislation through at the time. Up until that point, if you recall, many, certainly in cities, towns and cities, public transport was run by the local authority. And there was the ability, you know, for cross subsidisation, etc. You know, you had the big campaign in London when Ken Livingstone and Labour came to power in 1981 and introduced the Fares Fair policy to massively reduce the cost of public transport. I mean, and they had a battle. I think it was Bromley that took a judicial review against the policy, and they won. And so there had to be, and they didn't completely scrap the Fares Fair policy, but they had to revise it, and there was, you know, an increase in the price. But it was still considerably lower than what, the equivalent is today for people. But I mean, you know, public transport is it's like a social service. It should be a right, and we should be looking at free transport rather than necessarily any cost for it. But yeah, I mean, the reason why we're in this situation is the 40-odd years of neoliberalism. You know, the kind of deregulation agenda, the privatization agenda, has led us directly to this car crash that we are experiencing right now.
Now, you've just brought this book out, Chris, called 10 Years Hard Labour. Obviously, hoping that some will learn some of the lessons from that. But, you know, you paint the picture in that book of a constant battle against forces that seem almost impossible to deal with, really. I mean, literally losing battle after battle. What makes you think that ultimately, there can be some victory for that?
Well, I mean, I think we could have won. We lost those battles inside the Labour Party because of the unwillingness of the leadership, the unwillingness of Jeremy Corbyn and the people around him to take on the right wing of the Labour Party and to fight back against the Zionist lobby. I think the commitment they thought was the way forward was a commitment to try and keep the Labour Party together, to stop a split. But ultimately, that would have been a good thing, in my opinion, because we needed to remove the people who were essentially sabotaging a progressive proposition that was not just popular with party members, it was popular with the country as a whole. Now, the Labour, I think we can forget about fighting. It is a lost cause. If we seek to make those changes through the Labour Party. But I think if you look at the unrest that we're seeing now with industrial disputes growing and the dissatisfaction in the country as a whole, and that will only intensify, I think, when these massive increases in fuel bills actually are implemented later this year. I think the time is now ripe for, a more radical left-wing alternative. And that's why I'm excited by the potential of this merger between the resist movement, the system change political party that's just been registered, and the Socialist Labour Party. The potential for that, I think, is enormous. If we can get the message out correctly, then, I think there's every reason to be hopeful that we can see and can bring about the sort of changes that we were hoping to implement when Jeremy Corbyn was first elected as leader of the Labour Party.
What about internationally, Chris? Because it may be that you're blindsided by a war in Europe. I mean, you know, we've now got this fighting going on in Eastern Europe.
Yes, I mean, it's a proxy war, isn't it? And, you know, frankly, I think if we'd had a Corbyn-led Labour government with a half-decent parliamentary Labour party, part of the difficulty and one of the reasons I was pushing for the democratisation agenda is that the vast majority of Labour MPs are not fit for purpose and would have sought to sabotage a Labour government. But let's assume we've got those democracy reforms through and we've got a Corbyn-led Labour government. Without overstating it, you know, there's a potential that Corbyn-led Labour government might have been able to use its influence to prevent this war from taking place in the first place. Because, you know, as a member of NATO, and that's a questionable thing, I think, you know, Britain should withdraw from NATO, and indeed NATO should be scrapped. But as a member of NATO, as a member, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, then, you know, that sort of government could have been using its influence to, you know, press for peace and to actually press to ensure that, you know, pressure was applied to Ukraine to commit to neutrality. And had that been done, then of course this war would never have started in the first place. I mean, that was the issue. It's NATO's expansionism which is the problem. So yes, I mean, that is a problem, there's no doubt about that, and that's driving many of the difficulties that we're currently experiencing. Energy companies, of course, are using the situation to profiteer, but I mean, a left leaning government that was committed to, you know, intervening in the economy, to, you know, bringing strategic industries into public ownership, could certainly prevent the sort of catastrophe that people are going to, well, already experiencing, but it's going to get even worse for people in the winter this year. And, you know, you have to look across. I mean, you know, there's no particular radical socialist governments in Europe. But, I mean, you know, just look across the English Channel and we see that the governments there are not allowing the fuel bills of their citizens to go through the roof in the way in which the laissez-faire approach of the current government is doing. And so there are things that can be done. So I don't think it's a question of being blindsided. I think it's a question of recognising, you know, the challenges that you're facing. But having a clear ideology, a clear, you know, political commitment to, you know, use the platform to bring about change. That's what I think having a political platform should be all about. But regrettably, you know, it seems to be the way, certainly within the Labour Party and definitely within the Conservative Party, that, you know, rather than doing and using the political power for the benefits of the many, it's used for the you know, to enrich the already super rich in this country.
Well, finally, Chris, looking at your book 10 Years Hard Labour, you do touch on this contentious 2017 general election. Looking back with hindsight, with the undermining going on of the Labour Party from within, I mean, this is people actively working against the election of Jeremy Corbyn from within Labour. It does look as if, with the fine result of all, that what they successfully did is actually prevented Jeremy Corbyn from becoming Prime Minister in 2017.
Well, yes, they certainly did. But my view was, and indeed I made this point to the Socialist Campaign Group, that actually that result was probably the best result that we could have achieved in terms of the opportunities that he gave us. Because if Jeremy had won the election in 2017, that Parliamentary Labour Party would have sabotaged the programme, and that would have been catastrophic in terms of credibility. So I was arguing that, given that we'd secured a hung parliament, that we could use that time to democratise the Labour Party. And as Tony Benn used to say, that, you know, you need to democratise the party in order to democratise society, to democratise the economy. So it was a means to an end. It wasn't simply a naval contemplating exercise, because unless some of these MPs were replaced, and unless we actually put the power in the hands of grassroots members, so that any of those right-wing MPs that survived the reselection procedures would then have the sword of Damocles hanging over their heads, as it were, so that they would be more circumspect and more respectful of the, you know, policy positions that the party had embraced, and indeed, you know, what the country wanted. I mean, let's be honest about it. I mean, it wasn't just simply, as I keep saying, Labour Party members that wanted this radical reform. It was overwhelmingly popular with the wider general public. I mean, even Giles Brandreth found that when he went looking for secret socialists in Guildford and stopping people on the street there, and people who identified as Conservative went through essentially what was Jeremy Corbyn's programme, and everybody was agreeing with it. So, you know, there was, a huge potential opportunity in a subsequent election, but you needed to get those democracy reforms through in order to be able to deliver your programme. But my books essentially, you know, charts that, but it also goes through the period with Ed Miliband, because let's remember when Ed Miliband was elected as the leader, his offer was that he was going to turn the page on New Labour. And people looked to him as a kind of, you know, a kind of left-wing alternative to the continuity New Labour candidate that was his brother, David Miliband. But then he never, ever followed through with any of that stuff. That's the tragedy of it. And indeed, it was Ed Miliband himself who said, and I used to quote this regularly at meetings that I addressed when I was engaged in the Democracy Review, that he said that if we'd listened to our members a bit more when we were in government, we wouldn't have made as many mistakes. And, you know, you can go through the list. There would have been no war in Iraq. There would have been no cuts to Social Security benefits for the poorest people in the country. There would have been no tuition fees, no academy schools, you know, no introduction of private healthcare into the National Health Service. We'd have had a proper industrial strategy. You know, we wouldn't have been offshoring jobs to low wage economies. And though the list goes on and on, you know, we would have regulated the economy again, regulated the financial sector, if we'd listened to the members. And that's why I was so passionate about a democratisation agenda, because, you know, members have got their heads screwed on, it seems to me, and have got their feet on the ground and more in touch with reality. And, you know, I was arguing that it would make MPs much better representatives, because, you know, members inevitably, ordinary grassroots members, are in the constituency 24/7, and there it should be and could be the eyes and ears of the parliamentarians, you know, and there needed to be that partnership, as it were, between the two. But of course, that was never agreed.
Sorry, Chris, what you're talking about actually reminds me of the press, you know, because in any big organisation, whether your listeners and viewers with the press or your membership when it comes to a political party, the tendency seems to be nowadays, and even actually with the police in law enforcement, the tendency seems to be loyal to your boss. And actually that can quite often mean forgetting about what the needs are of the, you know, the grassroots, the people at the bottom. And what worries me about all of this concentration of power seems to be going on, is that as we kick into this winter and we got more and more people that cannot afford to feed their kids, heat their homes, all this sort of thing, is we start to get the seeds of what happened in Nazi Germany, the sort of problems that happened before the Second World War here in Britain. And it's a potential kind of carpet for fascism.
Well, that's not overstating the seriousness of the situation. And that's why I think what I've been talking about with this merger between system change stroke the resist movement and the Socialist Labour Party is so crucially important, actually, because I hope that can grow and capture the imagination of people who are obviously dissatisfied with the present state of affairs. And provide an alternative to, you know, a populist sort of right, extreme right wing alternative. And that's the danger in a situation of, you know, severe economic stress, that, you know, it can go one of two ways. I mean, there can be a shift to the far right, to a, you know, fascistic alternative. Our job, it seems to me, is to try and encourage people to, you know, go in a more progressive direction. But that's not being offered, obviously, by, you know, no mainstream political parties offering that. Certainly not the Labour Party. It's just more of the same. And so that's not going to inspire people. And it does leave the way clear, if we're not careful, for that, you know, far right alternative that you mentioned. And, you know, the consequences of that just don't bear thinking about. And so we do need to be vigilant. No,
actually, yeah, I think they do bear thinking about. And if we do, history may even repeat itself. Anyway, look, thanks very much, Chris. Your book is called 10 Years Hard Labour. It's just out. How do listeners get hold of it?
Well, they can order it through Waterstones. They can order it through the publisher if they want to, or indeed through Amazon. If they, I know some people have ideological objections to that, and I understand that. But yes, I mean, you should be able to order it, you know, directly from Waterstones, or go into the shop and, you know, get it there. Or indeed, people can just simply look at my social media profile, and the pinned tweet and the pinned Facebook post gives details about the book and where you can order it from. So people can do it that way if they want to as well.
Well, I've got another suggestion. If you're wandering into any bookshop, you can ask for it. It's called 10 Years Hard Labour. And if they don't have a copy, you can say, well, why isn't it in the window?
Indeed. Well, I'm all for that.
So. Okay. Chris Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries, all the best.